Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. In a recent book, the founder of the Interfaith Youth Corps, Eboo Patel, writes, "Diversity is simply a demographic fact. Pluralism is a hard-won achievement." What he means, of course, is that you could have, say, four or five white families and four or five black families living on the same block. But unless there is a vital sense of friendship, respect, and acceptance that weaves all of the families together, there's not really going to be the kind of environment that would be enviable or healthy. The same is true with faith communities. Just because people of various religions exist in the country doesn't give us bragging rights. The aforementioned quote from Patel is found in a fascinating article by Shadi Hamid entitled "The Difficulty with Diversity. Can American Pluralism Make Room for an Islam That is Truly Different?" In this essay, Dr. Hamid asks important questions about the great American experiment and its acceptance of this faith that still seems so very foreign to a large number of citizens. A little bit about our guest today. Shadi Hamid is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. He is the author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World, and co-editor of Rethinking Political Islam. His first book, Temptations of Power, was named a Foreign Affairs Best Book of 2014. An expert on Islam and politics, Hamid served as director of research at the Brookings Dora Center until January 2014. He received his B.S. and M.A. from Georgetown University and his Ph.D. in political science from Oxford University. We welcome to Common Threads Dr. Shadi Hamid. Hello, Shadi.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. So to begin the conversation, you say in this article, which, by the way, is in a Comment magazine, correct? That's where I found that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You talk about the mainstream of Islaming here in the United States, and you say that it comes at a cost. What is that cost? And perhaps we can really flesh out the meaning of mainstreaming.
Yeah. So first of all, I mean, what's interesting about the Trump era is that we see higher levels of anti-Muslim sentiment. And I think that when Trump first was elected, many Muslims were afraid, and rightfully so. And there was a sense that this could be the worst time for Muslims in America, even exceeding the aftermath of 9/11. But there are aspects of that. But what I try to get at in the piece is that there has been a positive mainstreaming of Muslims in cultural and political life. And we hear and see Muslims in prominent places and positions on a regular basis. We've just had two Muslim congresswomen elected for the first time. For example, you have a Muslim comedian hosting the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Muslim actors, Muslims being featured in TV and movies. And we do have, you know, we do have Trump to thank for at least a little bit of this, in the sense that Trump, by making Muslims a major campaign issue starting in 2015, he basically propelled us into the mainstream, and everyone started talking about us and thinking about it. And this has a negative side, that there is a partisan divide where if Democrats want to portray themselves or show that they're anti-Trump, a good way of doing that is by being pro-Muslim, because they want to be, they want to emphasize how they're basically the opposite of Trump. And this is an important way to do that. It's great to see Democrats embracing the Muslim community here in the United States. But if that also means that Republicans become increasingly associated with anti-Muslim sentiment, then we have a problem in the long run, right? So that's part of what I'm talking about on when it comes to the idea of how a community becomes more mainstream. The second part of the question on whether this mainstreaming comes at a cost. What I mean there is, so the more Muslims are accepted, they're accepted especially on the left and within the Democratic Party as another minority group among the kind of diverse tableau of American minorities, again, which is great, but it means that Muslims are increasingly seen as basically a secular group that has secular grievances like any other minority. So Muslims come to be appreciated more for their minority status, basically, and for their suffering or potential suffering under the Trump administration. And they cease to be seen primarily as a faith group that has its own set of theological convictions and beliefs. So in other words, the emphasis shifts from faith to secular identity. So I think there's a question that Muslims have to ask themselves, and it is a question Muslims are asking themselves: do they want to be just another minority group? And how important is it for them to emphasize their theological difference? And that gets to the question that you raised at the start about how we come to terms with diversity and difference. Is difference something to be embraced, or is it better for us to be more similar or to emphasize sameness?
Well, there's a couple of things here that we can go into. So, for instance, part of what you're saying reminds me of the Jewish experience in the 20th century. So you had a number of people coming over here from Europe, mainly, who were Jewish. And you had this struggle, how Jewish are we going to be, or how different are we going to look? Are we going to wear all black with the talis hanging out and growing our beards and wearing the hats? Are we going to be wearing yarmulkes, or are we just going to sort of fit in? Are we going to join a Reform synagogue that has its services in English as opposed to Hebrew? How are we going to turn Hanukkah into pseudo Christmas? Do you see any correlation there?
Certainly, and I think that there is a lot Muslims can learn from previous debates within the Jewish community. That said, I think there is one main difference, and Eva Patel in the book, and I should also say it really is an excellent book. He wonders whether one solution to the problem, if you will, of diversity or too much diversity is to basically expand the Judeo-Christian tradition to include Muslims. So he says, well, if Christians were able to get past their anti-Semitism and incorporate Jews, why couldn't that theoretically be done with Muslims? And then you'd have something like, I don't know, a Judeo-Christian Muslim tradition that emphasizes our Abrahamic common origins, I suppose. Now, the problem with that has to do, Muslims look different a lot of the time. And this is where the ethnic or racial component comes in. It's easier to incorporate Jews because Jews generally look white. And this is where you get an interesting overlap between ethnic difference and theological difference. And they are different things, but they can sometimes be intertwined in complex ways. And that is always going to be a challenge with Muslims in America, that there is going to be a more obvious perception of foreignness that isn't very easy to obscure or to get past. And I think that's fine, because I don't consider foreignness to be a problem, and I don't think it's a problem if Muslims look different or have different kinds of names, or they also display more obvious signs of religious practice, for example, through the headscarf. I don't think any of those things are problems. But what it does mean is that there isn't an easy catch-all solution where you say, well, let's just bring them into the existing Judeo-Christian tradition. The other thing is that Jews have been quite successful at integrating. And this gets to the question, which I kind of posed as an open-ended one in the article, is that good, and does it come at a cost? And there is that debate within the Jewish community, and you have communities of ultra-Orthodox Jews that have very strongly resisted secularization, but we do see high levels of intermarriage. We do see Reform Judaism, which in part is a way to has helped the Jewish community become more integrated because it's less theologically distinctive, right? Now, I think it's harder to do that with Islam for a variety of complex reasons. I mean, there isn't an equivalent to Reform Judaism in Islam. And generally, we do see here in the U.S., but also in Europe, relatively high levels of religious observance among American Muslims and European Muslims. Now, it's possible that that could change in coming generations, but it's also possible that it won't, and we'll continue to see a gap in religious observance between, say, American non-Muslims and American Muslims. And then we have to ask ourselves, is that gap something that we can be comfortable with? And I would argue that it should be something that we can be comfortable with. And it's part of this acceptance of diversity and difference, this idea, again, that difference is something to be embraced. So even if there is a religious community like Muslims that maybe is more outwardly practicing and maybe isn't as secularized, that we say this is part of what makes America great. And it's not something where we should say, hey, Muslims, you're taking a little bit longer with this whole secularization thing. Jews did this more quickly. Why can't you follow suit? I think that would be a problematic way to approach it, because it assumes that all religious communities are basically the same and that all of them should go through a similar process of secularization.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Dr. Shadi Hamid. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and we are talking about an article that he wrote in Comment Magazine, The Difficulty with Diversity: Can American Pluralism Make Room for an Islam That is Truly Different? There's a few things that you said in there that got me curious. First of all, what you said about the ethnic difference. That is clearly true, and one of the great pieces of evidence to the existence of that issue is that Islamophobia has spread beyond Islam, where you have Sikhs, Hindus, and I believe even Middle Eastern Christians dealing with Islamophobia, and they're not Muslim, but they quote unquote look Muslim. So you are correct that is one issue that they deal with. Another is, it reminds me that I have seen so much in my experience dealing with so many people in various faith communities here through the Interfaith Dialogue Association. I see a couple of different ways in which people respond to being in this culture where you're a minority. One is to run away from it, for a Jew to become an uber reform Jew, so reformed that they only go to synagogue on Christmas and Easter, you know, that far. And other times you see people who wrap themselves up in their religion more than they did when they were in their original country. Do you see those two responses?
Yeah, so I think that we saw some of the running away post 9/11. And I remember at the time I was in college that there were some people who just didn't want to, some people who were Muslim who just didn't want to have much to do with the Muslim community, because of all the negative attention. And, you know, so I think that that's one possibility. I think what we're seeing under the Trump administration, though, is more of the opposite. Because if you live in an urban area and you're in a more liberal environment, there isn't social pressure to be less obviously Muslim. Because, again, it's kind of cool to be Muslim now, you know? Now, of course, if you lived in Alabama or Mississippi, it would be a little bit different, but it is still the case that the vast majority of American Muslims live either in urban areas or near major urban centers. So I think what we're seeing now is, and in the piece I mentioned, the really, really interesting case of the comedian Aziz Ansari, who has, in the Trump era, become more open about talking about his Muslim background. And that's quite different than a few years back when he said that he was at one point an atheist, or he's also said that he's in the past that he's not religious. But now we see Aziz Ansari becoming more comfortable with his Muslim identity. Now, that doesn't mean, we don't know, and it doesn't necessarily mean that he's theologically Muslim. And that leads to this new category of Muslim that Eboo Patel talks about in the book, which is this idea of social Muslims, or we could also call them cultural Muslims. So people who value their Muslim background or their Muslim origins in some way, but aren't necessarily theologically committed to the creedal aspects of Islam as a religion and as a set of beliefs. And what's interesting is that Aziz Ansari has been embraced, even though he hasn't necessarily said full on, "I am now a Muslim," right? And I think that that's a really interesting case, that you have this new category, and I think more young American Muslims are being comfortable, and they're like, "Oh, you know, we don't know exactly what Aziz Ansari believes, and we don't want to get into big debates about theology and who isn't a Muslim. If he's talking about his Muslim background, that's great. Let's embrace that." So that we are seeing that. And, you know, personally, I think that overall is a good thing, because I do think mainstreaming is important for minority communities. But again, there is this trade-off. And I think that if you're coming at it from a more conservative Muslim standpoint, where you're trying to protect the religious beliefs and identity of the community, you might look at that and say, what is a social Muslim? That's not even a thing. And I remember when I was younger having some of these debates in the Muslim community, and it was often said that, Muslims are different than Christians in this regard, because a lot of Christians are just nominal Christians, but they don't even really believe in Christ, and they're not committed to the theological core convictions, and they're just basically cultural Christians, right? And these Muslims would say, well, Muslims are different because we don't have that category of cultural Muslim. You can't be a cultural Muslim. But now in our own community here in the U.S., we are having that debate, and there is this category. And I think we're going to see, we may see signs of tension around what exactly it means to be a cultural Muslim.
Once again, a comparison to Jews. So many Jews in America only identify with the culture. They're very, very quick to say, yes, I am Jewish, but I'm only culturally Jewish. I'm not religious. And, you know, it's a thing. It's something that is accepted. And it's interesting, because I know people who would identify as cultural Jews only, and yet they still have some tenuous connection to a synagogue. It's very interesting, and we'll have to see if this happens in Islam. And it's also interesting that you have Muslims who, again, they don't quite know where Ansari is theologically, but they're willing to accept him and embrace him. It reminds me, too, one time I was in a Sikh Gurdwara, And I was watching a small filmed presentation or a PowerPoint on Sikhism and Sikhs in America. And they mentioned a few Sikhs who have gone on to become accomplished in whatever their field was. Mm. And one of them that was up there was Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley is a Methodist, you know. But she was born a Sikh, and so, but the, boy, if they can grab onto anybody.
Look, I mean, sometimes you take what you can get, right? And I think that if you find that you're in a difficult position as a community, there is really this desire to belong and to be accepted. Coming of age in the post 9/11 period, whenever, and it was still quite rare then, and as I said, it's become more common now, but like when prominent American Muslims are on TV or are featured, or you see a Muslim character in a TV show, there's still this part of me that's like, wow, this is really cool. This is really amazing. And I think that for many of us, that's a relatively new experience. And there is a kind of pride that we are making it in a way in American society. And then at some level, you prioritize that over, again, the theological debate. Because let's be honest, we don't always want to be getting into the complex theological aspects. And it's easier to talk about culture, especially for those of us who live in quite secularized urban centers, and the language that you use in everyday life is not a theological one. The language you use is one of minority groups, one of representation, of positionality, of intersectionality. That's the kind of context that many of us find ourselves in, which again ties back to this idea of becoming embraced within the Democratic Party and within the left, where you have a lot of these relatively recent ideas of intersectionality really coming in vogue.
What about the idea that, okay, we understand there is a difference in between Islam and Judaism and Christianity that you mentioned? A significant part of it is ethnic, and so many Muslims here are first generation. So we have people from foreign countries, and oftentimes they still maintain creating families within that ethnic community. But of course, by the second generation, people aren't speaking with accents. They're much more acclimated to American culture. They like baseball. They watch television, et cetera, et cetera. I think that a lot of the concern that some people have isn't the theology, because they get, okay, they're different spiritually. And if they know anything, they know that there are certain common roots that they have with the other Abrahamic traditions. But it's the practice. So, for instance, I've heard people on the right, I've heard right-wing talk show hosts say something about a company who is being sucked into this whole Islam business by offering prayer rooms, which I think, that's just capitalism. You want the best people to work for you, and you want to accommodate those people, whatever their religion. And the prayer rooms aren't specifically Muslim prayer rooms. I'm sure that Christians and Hindus can go use them as well. But let's face it, they were created for Muslims. Talk about that. Have you had any experience, either personally or academically, with the issue of accommodating Muslim prayer practices, and anything else, diet, whatever?
Yeah, sure. Well, so I think this gets at a bigger issue of so we talk about private religious beliefs, and we talk about those as being personal and spiritual, but when it gets complicated is when those private faith commitments have public implications. So when we ask religious groups to keep it private, sometimes that can't really happen, because especially I would say in Islam, there are inevitably going to be public manifestations. So you gave one example of prayer rooms. There are other examples, the obvious one being Muslim, conservative Muslim women or observant Muslim women wearing the headscarf. That's visible. Everyone can see it. There is also the refraining from alcohol, which in a way is public and is something that you can see and experience visibly with observant Muslims. Fasting is, again, it's something that is out there. You can see. I think that that does potentially make things more challenging, and it has made things more challenging, especially in Europe, where you have much more aggressively secular cultures. And this also relates to food. So you have debates in France now, where Muslim students demanding demanding sounds a bit aggressive, but asking for halal food options or asking for pork not to be served at lunch, especially if the majority of students are Muslim, which is the case in some French neighborhoods. So those are things that have not just public implications, but also legal implications. Now, when it comes to the U.S., I think it's interesting that you have criticisms of, say, prayer rooms from the right wing of the political spectrum, but you'd think that the right in America would be more sympathetic to expressing your faith in the public sphere, because that is something that evangelicals, let's say, have long wanted for themselves, and they've criticized our increasingly secular culture for trying to force their faith into the private realm.
Let me stop you right there, only because we are out of time for this particular episode, but you're on a roll. I want you to come back next week and we'll continue this conversation.
Would love to. Yeah, sure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and Dr. Shadi Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, has been our guest today, talking about his article, The Difficulty with Diversity: Can American Pluralism Make Room for an Islam That is Truly Different? Please join us next week as we continue this conversation here on WGVU.